Welcome to this Monday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you had a great weekend and are at it trying to fill out that bracket. Coming up in just a bit, Essentia Health Medical Oncologist Dr. Basim Cabrosi joins Main Street to explain how colorectal cancer is diagnosed and treated today, from staging and chemotherapy to newer options like immunotherapy. But we begin today with the second part of our interview with Watford City's Mayor Phil Riley. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and last Wednesday, we had the pleasure of beginning a conversation with Mayor Phil Riley of Watford City. Of course, Watford City was at the center and is at the center of North Dakota's oil country. It's a community that experienced one of the fastest growth periods in the state during the Bakken boom, and we have much more to talk about, and we continue our discussion today. Welcome back to Main Street, Mayor.
Thanks for having me back, Craig. I enjoyed our first discussion. I'm looking forward to this one.
We ended talking about water and bids that were opened last week. I want to begin our discussion today about Watford City's Water Resource Recovery Facility. Tell me about that. It's been described as one of the first of its kind in North Dakota.
Yep. So it's also a very polite way of saying our sewer system.
Yeah.
So we had to figure out a way. We had to figure out a way to get rid of the waste. And we were a lagoon system. And what a lagoon system is, for those of you that aren't familiar, maybe you haven't had any experience with it, it's gigantic ponds of water, and the sediment gets to below a certain level where anaerobic microorganisms take over and it breaks down the waste. And it actually, it's a sediment pond, and it helps clean up the water that then can be used for things like we would ship it out to our golf course, dilute it and use it to water our golf course, or you test it and you can discharge it into a river or creek. We've never really had to discharge much. Our golf course has always needed water. And so what we did is we took out several, we had to bond that project. Our water resource reclamation bonds, as we refer to them as, were very kind of our first steps in growing our community. If you can't get rid of the waste, you can't bring in people. And it's kind of interesting to talk about. Those were some of the biggest bonds we've ever taken out as a community. Turns out it takes a lot of money to build that type of infrastructure. I was really surprised. But the water that goes in compared to the water that goes out is actually cleaner than the creek that we would discharge it into. But like I said before, even when we were a lagoon system, we actually ship that water to our golf course, and we use that water to keep our fairways green, which if you haven't seen Watford City's golf course, here's a little plug. Come on out and see Fox Hills Golf Course. It's a gorgeous 18-hole course that where I'm hoping to open up and be able to take my dad and my son out and have three generations of Riley boys golfing again this summer.
It won't be long till you'll have that opportunity, Mayor. Mayor, what about transportation in the area? The US 85 four-lane expansion between Watford City and the Long X Bridge was celebrated as a major safety and commerce step. That project, I think, was reported around $100 million. What differences are you seeing from that corridor upgrade? And are there other transportation priorities that you have?
Yep, absolutely. So just a couple weeks ago, what's called the Ports to Plains Alliance. It includes the Theodore Roosevelt Expressway, which is Highway 85, the Heartland Expressway, which goes through what we call the breadbasket, and then the I-27, which is the Texas side. We were all in D.C. lobbying for getting some dollars to help fund that continued expansion. If you look at this map of the United States, you'll notice that we connect east to west really well. We're not doing so good on north to south. The last interstate was built in 1992. Of course, the interstate system started after World War II when we decided we needed to be able to transport weapons a lot like Germany. Germany's big program was they had the Autobahn. They could get weapons anywhere. We came home and thought, man, it'd be nice to do that with full food, fuel, fiber, safety and security. So we started the interstate system. Working on that, we were able to four-lane our roads from Williston to Watford to begin with. And then we took that all the way down to the north unit of the park. what that has done for Watford City has been amazing. The first thing it has done is it has kept our people safe. Now, at one point, that stretch between Williston and Watford City was one of the most dangerous stretches of highway in the state of North Dakota. The 20 years I spent in the fire department, we didn't put out fires. We went to crashes. We killed more people on Highway 85 than I care to talk about. When we opened that four lane, that dropped dramatically. It's amazing what kind of stressors were created by the two lane and the super two. Of course, it was a road that wasn't prepared to handle that kind of traffic. Highway 85 handles more traffic. The two lane Highway 85 handles more traffic than any four lane road in the state of North Dakota. I actually have the numbers in front of me. As a matter of fact, now these are oversized, overweight loads. These are not your normal day traffic. These are loads that need a permit just to travel. Highway 85 saw almost 46,000 permitted loads in 2025, compared to I-29 saw 26,000, I-94 saw 40,000. You know, it's kind of amazing that we're seeing higher than our two interstates in North Dakota. We're seeing higher permitted loads on Highway 85. So we're working hard to get that four lane. It's a great plan. It moves, like I said before, food, fuel, and fiber. It's going to be an excellent corridor to connect us down to our southern partners. You know, you always hear about how we're kind of a little mini Texas. We're the third largest oil producer in the state. A lot of our products are the same products that they use in the oil field in Texas, so we should connect the two. It was a great program. It was a great meeting. We got to meet with everybody from Julius Fedorchuk to Ted Cruz, and I was happy to be part of it.
Population trends in the area. You had mentioned last week that school enrollment is up 10% this year, and some schools are operating at 90 to 95% capacity. What have you learned about whether families are planning to stay in the Bakken, in Watford City, and what will that require then from you, from the city?
Well, just like last week, it's going to require a place for them to live. We're going to need some rooftops. And we're constantly, much like everybody else in our area, we're constantly working on that. The benefit Watford City has, and I really have to give this to our superintendent, Steve Holland, and the other leaders in our community, all the way down to just the average Joe. When we decide we need a school, we voted in hands down, right? So to build a school, you have to bond. To get a bond, you need 60%. Approval through vote, where our neighbors to the north, Williston, had a terrible time building a school. I don't know that we've ever had a vote that wasn't at least 95% positive. Wow. To do that. Yeah, we've, you know, and that could fall back on the shoulders of our past Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford when he was here. You know, he worked closely with our school superintendent, Dr. Holland, who's another amazing person. If you ever need to visit with somebody, he's just a vast wealth of knowledge and information, especially when it comes from building a school. So Watford City is my hometown. I graduated high school here. I graduated with a class of 42. My daughter's going to graduate with a class of 140, which I find amazing. I like to tell people during City Government Week when I go to the grade school that there are more people in the school system in Watford City right now than were in Watford City when I graduated high school. That's an amazing statistic and how we've been able to grow and keep up with that. We have a cultural fair in Watford City, which is an amazing thing. It's something to put on your calendars. We all go, you get to go to the high school, you get to try these native foods and you get to see dancing and it's a wonderful opportunity just to see the different cultures that were brought into Watford City and that we get to experience now on a daily basis because of the industry and what the industry's done for us. It's been an absolute blessing. It's been a blast. My daughter's a senior this year and it's kind of fun that when I was going to high school, you know, we used to talk about learning Spanish in school. One of my daughter's good friends is German. We have one's Italian. We I don't know how many countries are represented in Montford City High School, and this isn't just a foreign exchange student program. These are just people that live here now. So we've done amazing things. It's very difficult to support a growing school system, but our school system does a great job. As long as we can put heads in beds and rooftops over those, I think our school system is going to continue to grow and do amazing things.
What about healthcare access, Mayor? Rural healthcare in this state and across this part of our country has always been an issue. In a community health needs assessments, residents cited barriers like transportation, insurance limitations, and distance to facilities. What role can city leadership play, or do you play, either directly or indirectly, to strengthen access to healthcare and then the recruitment of healthcare to the community?
So we actually saw that in a special session that there was a big healthcare discussion during our special legislative session that can only be called by the governor, and we got to do that because there was some funding available. But communities like Watford City, or one that was brought up this year was Elgin, North Dakota, how difficult it was to keep their hospitals, we're not going to say profitable because they weren't, but to keep them open, not just to keep them staffed, but to keep them open. If you would lose a hospital like Watford City, we're lucky enough that we have Williston 45 miles away, we have Dickinson 90 miles away. But if you would lose a hospital like Elgin, North Dakota, you know, you're traveling 90 miles, not just 45. But one thing we did in wonderful Watford City, and I say wonderful Watford City because the people of Watford City came together and we passed the sales tax. And what we did with that sales tax is we actually used a percentage of it to build a new hospital. And of course, with assistance from local leaders in our community, some folks that were willing to donate some funds, some communities, some companies that helped us, we were able to build a wonderful facility, and we were able to attract healthcare providers to McKenzie Health. Now, you may not have heard McKenzie Health yet, but you will. We have satellite offices growing slowly from Williston, Tioga, all over the state. We have a vast range of services offered now. You can get your knee replaced. My dad had his knee replaced in Watford City, which is amazing. My dad lives two blocks from the hospital. That's pretty neat. We have an oncology center. And we did that because we had the support of our local community. They were willing to spend a little bit more every day on things like eggs and milk to help us provide assistance to McKenzie Health. We have good partners with Sanford. They have come in and they bring specialists in too. But that's not something to be taken lightly. Healthcare is super expensive, and keeping people, professionals in your system is a difficult thing to do. You know, it's especially when we're talking about Western North Dakota, it's tough to talk a young physician. How do you tell some gal that maybe she met her husband and they were both doctors and they went to UND, but then they got to go to New York and they've been in all these big communities and you're saying, hey, I know you like the big city life. Why don't you move back to North Dakota's big city, 8,000 people, and, you know, and become an allergist in the great city of Watford City. But we actually have a local gal. She's a Stenjum. She's actually, I heard she was moving back to McKenzie Health and we're going to have an allergist in Watford City. And it's that active role we take, not only in our community, but extending our reach to other folks that helps us survive. And we couldn't do that at all without the support from our community. That's a wonderful thing we have in Watford City. We have such great community support. I can go on and on about the funds that we can come up with, but essentially those funds are tax dollars. Those tax dollars we were able to turn back into brick and mortar and help offset the growing costs of healthcare.
We're enjoying our continued conversation with Phil Riley. He's a native of Watford City and currently the community's mayor. We've had lots to talk about a community that's experienced one of the fastest growth periods in the state during the Bakken boom. What about your downtown, Mayor, and economic diversification? People in boom towns often like to tout diversification as the way to continue a long time feeling of success in the community. What's your story? And tell me about your Main Street Square plan, if you would.
Absolutely. So first, I'm going to brag a little bit about our Main Street. Our Main Street was a project that we actually had completed before the boom. Before the boom, Watford City had a grand total of $367,000 in debt. And that's something we did because the community leaders figured out a way to do it. Now, with our Community Square program that we're working on right now, one thing you need for diversification is you need store frontage. One thing we realized is our Main Street was full. We had some buildings that you were unable to occupy, some buildings that were occupied that very much needed a facelift. And what the city and our community decided to do, we got together and we're going to put up what we like to call our community square. We're taking a vacant lot on Main Street. We're taking a couple surrounding buildings and we're going to put up frontage. You know, we're going to bring retail space back to Main Street, which is severely needed. And we were lucky enough to get a grant to help us with that, to help us with the planning and the design process. It's going to be a long, arduous task to get that put up. But there are several areas on Watford City's Main Street that could use a facelift. Our next project will be the old Senex Station. We'll start working with the owners of that. That's an out-of-state company that owns the old Senex Station. But, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that we can do to help increase frontage, right? It's hard to have retail if you don't have retail space.
I think
anything we can do to get retail space to open up.
I think a recent signal of retail confidence, this might seem a little curious to some, but you opened a McDonald's in late 2025. What did that opening mean to the community? Development staff described it as a flagship that can attract additional retail. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. You know, you've never seen a failing McDonald's. I know that's kind of weird to say out loud, but if you sit back and you think, you don't see empty McDonald's. If there's an empty McDonald's, it's because they moved to a different area and they build bigger, better, faster. But once you have a McDonald's in your community, you always have a McDonald's in your community. What that meant to Watford City was not only it gave us a fast food chain, but it kind of signaled another era for Watford City where we could start attracting places like McDonald's. You know, we had a Hardee's, we had a Subway, but everybody, McDonald's is known, you know, worldwide. My kids were so excited when we built a McDonald's. I got to be there for the grand opening. I was excited about it. It's just when you see, and then that falls back into economic growth. When you see a investor from Bismarck, North Dakota, saying, you know what, I am comfortable with the economy in Watford City, North Dakota. I'm not only going to buy property, I'm going to get the property. I'm going to put a building up. I'm going to bring in employees. I'm going to make a go at this. That's huge for us. When someone from not in our community, someone that doesn't live here, wants to invest like that, then that signals other people from throughout the state. It kind of tells you when you get that kind of action, it kind of tells you that, hey, this is a good, safe community to expand in. They can start looking at us and see our stable growth. They can look at our high school and our school system and see a year after year increase in our school population, and they can realize that this is a stable area. It's a good place to invest. And what that does for Watford City is it brings opportunities and other products and retail to the people that have decided to make Watford City their home, which if you've ever been here, you'd want to make it your home too. It's a pretty great place.
Mayor, for listeners elsewhere in North Dakota who still think of Watford City mainly as an oil patch community, what's the most important thing they're not getting that they misunderstand about your community today?
You know, a lot of times people don't understand. And, and here I won't even just talk about Watford City. I'll talk about Western North Dakota as a whole. Everybody still says, is it still like the Wild West out there? No, it's not the Wild West. Of course, we've put in a lot of infrastructure to help us with when they talked about Wild West, they were talking about traffic and crime. Our crime isn't any higher per capita than any other town, really. Our transportation network has increased dramatically. But the best part about Western North Dakota is the landscape. It's the people and it's the community itself. I like to say we're the gateway to the north unit of the park. You know, we have a 17th Presidential Library opening up 4th of July in Medora. That's just a hop, skip, and a jump south of here, celebrating 250 years of this great nation. That's the type of things that happen in Western North Dakota. People should stop by and look at. It's a beautiful landscape. It's kind of like the Black Hills, but inverted. And you get to meet some of the nicest people you've ever met in your entire life when you stop into a local cafe for a piece of pie, or you stop into a gas station for a soda. It's just everybody's happy to be here. And if you stop by for a visit, you'll realize why.
Mayor, if oil stays the engine, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, what does the next chapter look like for Watford City?
You know, our next chapter is I like to say our next chapter is yet to be written. Where the author is thinking we're going to go, of course, the energy industry is always going to be a driver. It always has been. You know, we also are lucky enough, we have an extremely beneficial product called agriculture. You know, it's always been, we used to be an agricultural community with an oil kicker. I know that's kind of swapped right now. We're an oil community with an egg kicker. But with the, you know, I mean, everybody's very excited. At one point, last week when we were talking, the day before we had our conversation, oil hit $118 for about 20 minutes, you know. But we've seen that before, and we understand what that looks like in Western North Dakota. We know the oil is going to settle out. What we do is we ride the waves. I do believe we're going to have to do some other style of exploration or production. I think there will be a need for enhanced oil recovery. A lot of people hear about that. I know carbon capture got a bad rap by a company that maybe didn't do the best job talking to property owners, but we're going to have to look at other ways to help move this oil out of the formation on a molecular level. So I think that's one thing we're going to have to look at, whether it be using CO2 to help lift the oil out or some other way of doing enhanced oil recovery. But overall, Watford City will survive. We have. We're a strong and vibrant community that we always find a way to make it work.
That's Watford City native and current Mayor Phil Riley. He's joined us to talk about the growth challenges and the future of one of North Dakota's most dynamic communities that's up in Northwest North Dakota. Mayor, it has been a pleasure. Best wishes to you and your community.
Greg, thank you so much for the opportunity to visit with you and get to be able to spread a little bit of the story that's happening over here. I hope people take an opportunity to come and visit this summer. There's a lot of action, a lot of beauty, and we'd sure love to see them.
Still to come on Main Street, advances in colorectal cancer treatment are giving patients new hope right here in North Dakota. That's after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and a colorectal cancer diagnosis can be frightening, but advances in treatment are giving many patients better outcomes and more options than ever before. At Essentia Health in Fargo, medical oncologist Dr. Basim Cabrosi works with patients after diagnosis, helping guide chemotherapy, targeted treatments, and long-term care. Dr. Cabrosi specializes in hematology and medical oncology and treats many forms of cancer, including colorectal cancer. In a recent case with Fargo resident Billy Kitzman, who was our guest previously on Main Street, chemotherapy began shortly after surgery and continues today as doctors work to eliminate remaining cancer cells and treat small metastatic lesions. Dr. Cabrosi joins us to talk about how colorectal cancer is treated today and what patients should know after hearing those life-changing words, "You have cancer." Dr. Cabrosi, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Cabrosi, when someone is diagnosed with colorectal cancer, what typically happens immediately next in terms of treatment planning?
Well, we discuss, of course, the diagnosis. And the diagnosis is the first step in managing any cancer and most problems. So you got to know what the problem is. Usually that requires a biopsy, which is obtained usually for colorectal cancer with a colonoscopy. So they get a piece of tissue and look at it under the microscope to make sure it's cancer. We check some characteristics of the cancer, and one characteristic that really influences treatment is the presence or absence of mismatch repair deficiency. That's some cancers, about 10%, will have an inability to correct DNA damage. And those cancers are exquisitely responsive to a new type of treatment called immunotherapy. So that's all obtained from the pathology report. The next step is staging, and that's with imaging studies such as a CAT scan or a PET scan to evaluate the stage of the disease, which is linked to the prognosis, which is kind of important for the patient to understand what their cure rates are.
Tell me a little bit more about stages, if you will. My understanding is very, very general that stage one is a relatively maybe new and treatable cancer. Stage four is a very advanced cancer that may or may not be treatable. Is that somewhat accurate?
It is. So stage one, two, and three in colon cancer are curable. Stage four used to be not curable, but today it is. And in many cancers, even when you have stage four disease and immunotherapy is one of the options that may be beneficial, even sometimes those cancers can be cured or go into long-term remissions over 5 years. Stage one in colon cancer or stage two are limited to the colon. Usually the treatment is surgery, and the cure rates for those range between 80 and 90% just with surgery. Most of the times, unless they have high risk features, no chemotherapy is required to improve that cure rate. Stage three is when the cancer spreads to lymph nodes. And that one requires some type of adjuvant therapy. Adjuvant therapy means systemic therapy, therapy that goes throughout the whole body and targets cancer cells after surgery. And stage four disease is when it leaves the organ and goes to other organs. With colorectal cancer, the most common site of spread is the liver because all the blood flows from the colon goes to the liver so that the nutrients can be packaged and sent to other organs. So that's the first site of disease spread. And since the early 2000s, we've known that if there's less than three lesions in the liver, that patient can be cured by addressing those lesions.
Chemotherapy to me is a very broad term. It can mean a lot of different things. For colorectal cancer, what does chemotherapy mean? And is it individualized and different from patient to patient?
So it is. So like I said, if their cancer has mismatch repair deficiency, then the treatment would include immunotherapy. That's a new change to the recommendations. Otherwise, since the 90s, treatment has consisted of a drug called 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil. And that used to be given as a bolus or all at once in 15 minutes. And it provided a 15% benefit. And then it was discovered that if you give it very slowly over 48 hours, the benefit goes up to 35%, and then there's no side effects or hardly any side effects. So the drug and the mechanism which you deliver it really affect the side effects and how effective it is. And there was a trial called the Mosaic trial to see if we add other things like oxaliplatin to it, can we improve the cure rates? And the benefit rate of adding a second drug is about 5%. With immunotherapy, if the patients are eligible for immunotherapy, that's knocked those numbers right out of the water.
One of the things that I've wondered about is recent news about changes in the ability of the National Science Foundation and other research institutes to look at diseases like cancer. Has that impacted you, Dr. Cabrosi? In other words, have you noticed a slowdown maybe in research that could be life-saving?
So in the 50s, most of the research was government funded through the NCI or the American Cancer Society. As time went on and the drugs got to be more profitable, drug companies started bearing most of that burden. And I think now they cover about 80% of the clinical trials. So the governments have backed off and they now cover about 20% of the research. And that's not necessarily good because even though the studies are conducted in an ethical manner, the study design will always be biased to the benefit of the drug company. So you still have countries like England and like Canada where you have social medicine. So they do sort of more independent or more less biased studies. So the study design there is aimed at saving money, which may be a bias in itself, but you have to look at all the information together. And for us to get the best recommendations for the patients, we usually follow guidelines like the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, where experts in a particular cancer meet and go over any new studies and update those guidelines sometimes five, six times a year, ensuring that the patients get the most up-to-date and reliable information.
Back to the topic of chemotherapy, what has been improved, or have there been improvements in side effects that we all hear about relative to chemotherapy, whether it's hair loss, whether it's severe nausea, extreme fatigue? Have there been improvements with chemotherapies relative to side effects recently?
Yes, so it depends. There's hundreds of chemotherapy drugs, each with their unique side effects. And very often we will administer pre-medications. The most successful ones have been for nausea. So whereas in the 70s and the 80s, people used to complain mainly of nausea as their major side effects. They didn't care if there was hair loss because they were throwing up all the time. But that's becoming a minimal side effect. Hair loss is being addressed in many situations with a scalp cooling device that cools the scalp, thus causing the blood vessels to constrict and less chemo getting to the hair follicle. And with many regimens that were universally causing alopecia, some patients can still look good. And that varies in importance patient to patient.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Cabrosi from Essentia Health. He specializes in hematology and medical oncology and treats many forms of cancer, including colorectal cancer. You mentioned, and Billy told us, that sometimes cancer spreads to other organs, in her case, and in some cases, as you referenced, the liver. First, how common is that? And next, she talked about a procedure she would be undergoing called RFA, or some type of radio frequency ablation. Tell us more about what that is.
So, radiofrequency ablation is the insertion of a probe into the center of the metastatic lesion, and the tip of that probe gets really hot and basically burns the tumor. It's very safe for tumors under 3 centimeters, so the smaller the better. One trap we fall into sometimes is the chemo is too good, so that the cancer shrinks so much that the lesion no longer becomes visible. And so then you have to follow up until it kind of grows back, and then you can aim for it and burn it. But that's a good problem to have.
I think one of the most striking things about my interview with Billy was how positive of a person that she is. You have visited with hundreds, I'm guessing, maybe even more, of folks who have gotten this life-changing diagnosis. Give us insight into how important mindset is that supports what you're trying to do from the perspective of a physician for cancer treatment.
Well, from my perspective, it makes my job a lot easier because we can focus on the cancer. We don't have to focus on the anxiety, which can be really a barrier to care.
And I'm guessing you see both.
Yes, I see both. And a lot of patients who start out anxious after a few weeks, they become back to normal or even positive. With Billy, what was unique is she was positive from the beginning. In fact, she was a ray of sunshine. She made everybody around her happy, other patients, the nurses. We're almost sad to sort of see her go at the end of the day because she is just, she has so much positive energy, and that's wonderful.
She talked a lot about support systems, and I hadn't really thought about support systems outside of maybe family for her, maybe family and friends. But she mentioned nutrition and other things that are now supporting her in her treatment here. How important is nutrition and counseling and survivorship care to a patient's outcome?
Oh, that's so important. It's so easy to focus on the cancer and forget about the life. This is a very disruptive diagnosis. No one expects it. No one saves for it. You need very often help from a whole team of providers like social workers, sometimes physical therapists, sometimes counselors, dietitians. The worst thing, I think, for a patient is to have questions or gaps in knowledge that are unanswered. So when we can address those and even have the patient taken care of from a financial standpoint, because sometimes that can also affect their life significantly. So we have a whole team that helps the patient through this difficult time.
What advances are out there that are exciting for you relative to colorectal cancer treatment that gives you even more hope than you have right now?
Well, one major statistic that we've noticed with colorectal cancer is the change in demographics. So, over the last 3 decades, the incidence of colorectal cancer has been sort of decreasing. All of a sudden, we have it decreasing in patients over 65 and increasing in patients under 50.
Why? Do we know?
We don't know why. We know the location of the cancer seems important. It seems to be in the last part of the colon. So in the what's called the sigmoid colon and the rectum. That's where these young people are having most of their cancers. And
Men and women.
yes, men and women and people think, the sigmoid colon acts as a storage space, and you think that it's, due to processed foods, junk foods. Some people start to think about pesticides and other things, microplastics, something from the environment. But you have to sort of separate what young people are eating versus what or exposed to, because it could be environmental exposure, versus the 65-year-olds whose rates are actually improving. So what do young people expose themselves to that older people don't? And there's a lot of research going on there. For now, what we've done is we've decreased the age for screening from 50 years of age to 45. But someone like Billy would be easily missed by the 45 even. So there's some work that has to be done on the screening and prevention.
So when you say screening, it's your best advice and the best advice now in all of the country that colonoscopies should start at age 45. Is that accurate?
Right. So colonoscopies do have a low but real complication rate. So the way they figure out the recommendation is they look how many lives can you save versus how many people get complications. And right now that number is 45. But there's other screening tests that are really non-invasive, like the test that's called the Cologuard test, which looks for DNA mutations in the stool. And I'm hoping that coverage for that will be sooner. Now, patients like Billy, are different. So screening studies are done in patients who are completely asymptomatic. With Billy, she was symptomatic. She was tired from her anemia. So it was a no-brainer to do the scopes at a young age. But what if a patient has no symptoms or hardly any symptoms and normal blood tests? At what age would you start screening the asymptomatic patients, keeping in mind the incidence, how often you're going to find something, and the damage? The damage can be complications from an invasive procedure like a colonoscopy, or financial damage from a test like a Cologuard or stool study.
Isn't it true that for most people with insurance, colonoscopy is covered?
Yes, usually there's a copay. Insurance has changed over time, and the price of getting health insurance has gone up. So people are sort of dealing with bigger deductibles. So it's becoming a challenge to navigate the insurance environment. But again, suppose that there was a price to pay and you're feeling fine. You'll be like, why should I? I have better things to do. I got to pay for my kids' colleges right now. I'll just postpone it for a year. Whereas if you have a toothache, you'll go to the dentist that very same day and demand it be taken care of within the hour. That's one of the challenges of getting compliance with screening studies.
My guest has been Dr. Basim Kabrosi. He's a medical oncologist at Essentia Health in Fargo, specializes in hematology and cancer care, including colorectal cancer. Dr. Kabrosi, the last word you would like to give to our listeners about what you would want them to hear from our discussion today?
I think raising awareness for colon cancer, especially in people who are under 50, this is a growing trend. Of course, I would like to emphasize the importance of daily exercise. So that's something that doesn't cost any money and decreases the incidence by about 20%. So we're talking about walking an hour, 3 or 4 times a week. And just general common sense things like staying away from processed foods, eating foods that you know what's in them, like real food, the same way your parents or your grandparents eat.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. Central broadcast of Main Street here on Prairie Public, up next, it's All Things Considered. 75 years ago, millions of Americans tuned in for a groundbreaking television moment, a public look at organized crime and political corruption in cities like New York. We revisit America's first televised introduction to the mafia on the next All Things Considered here on Prairie Public. Tonight at 8 p.m. Central, following the 7 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, you've just made your favorite sandwich and are about to take a big bite when a huge fly lands on it. That instant feeling of disgust may be unpleasant, but it serves an important purpose. Hidden Brain explores what this powerful emotion is trying to protect us from. That's at 8 p.m. Central tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. Millicent Ficken spent her career studying bird behavior and communication. The first woman to earn a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Cornell in 1960, Ficken authored over 100 scientific papers. She discovered that male hummingbirds have a whole repertoire of songs rather than just one, outlined the linguistic differences between penguin species, and showed that chickadees take turns singing in the morning. She was also fascinated by how birds play together. Play is one of the most mysterious activities of animals, Ficken wrote. Her seminal 1997 article, Avian Play, was an exhaustive attempt to categorize these behaviors. One example was the great frigate bird, a black seabird with a prominent red throat pouch. Ficken noted that young great frigate birds swoop, pick up, and then drop leaves or other floating objects. She compared it to a kitten playing with a ball of yarn and suggested it might help fledglings learn to catch jumping fish and even steal food from other birds. Ficken found lots of evidence for avian play, but unlike mammals, who sometimes play purely for fun or social bonding, she showed that bird play almost always has a more pressing purpose. They're practicing a skill they need to survive. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 16th. An old postcard of the Wahpeton Indian School shows a line of buildings and a cow minding her own business. She was Beauty Calantha Frisian, a retired dairy champion whose celebrity status entitled her to graze along 7th Street in view of the public. On this date in 1932, the Farmer Globe reported that Beauty would enter the state competition, having already won all the national Indian Service honors for milk and butterfat production. The Government Indian School herd ranked 3rd in the state, while the state penitentiary herd ranked 1st, based on average butterfat per cow. But the second-ranking cow was 24 pounds under the Indian School champion. Breeders were very interested in this cow, who continued heavy production even at 14 years old. The school could not sell any government stock, so surplus offspring were transferred to other Indian schools, from Alaska to Arizona. The original herd sire came from the famous Femco Farm in Breckenridge, Minnesota, from which subsequent sires were also purchased. A succession of Indian school cows, whose registered first names were Beauty, continued to make local news. In 1946, J.W. Wellington, supervisor of farms and dairies in the Washington office, visited Wahpeton to evaluate the desirability of farming and dairy activities in the school program. Wahpeton had the best dairy herd in the Indian Service. But school superintendent Morrison and Wellington concluded that milk could be purchased more cheaply locally than produced at the school, and that students weren't receiving enough academic training to justify the time spent on the dairy herd and other agricultural activities. On January 2, 1947, in 26 below zero weather, the herd was shipped to boarding schools in Oklahoma and New Mexico. Equipment, buildings, and holdings connected with the Wahpeton Indian School were later put up for sale by bid. The following concerns received parcels of farmland: the Wahpeton Cemetery Association in 1956, the State School of Science in 1957. In return, the science school would provide 10 tuition scholarships per year for 10 years to qualified Native American students. And the city of Wahpeton in 1959, which received by direct grant 14 acres to be used for local education and recreational purposes. No glass beads or public land acknowledgments sealed the deal. Wellington later became the school superintendent. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lisa Erdrick. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
The Iran war has choked off oil to Asia. How is that impacting the region?
We've seen universities closed in Bangladesh, schools closed throughout Pakistan.
And President Trump says NATO faces a, quote, very bad future if allies don't help the U.S. in Iran. Will they? That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as a podcast. Tomorrow on the show, Spelling for Supremacy the story of North Dakota's first recorded spelling bee that was held way back in April of 1885. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.